Chapter 13. Vampiric Maneuvers in the Dark. "Hi, honey, I'm home." I needn't have bothered calling. The house is dark and cold, the heating turned down. I pick up the two crates and trudge inside. One of them complains vocally, the other reeks silently. That one can live under the stairs. The loud one I carry into the kitchen, where it moans like a particularly deranged ghost, as I hang my coat and gloves up in the hall. Then I turn the lights on, fiddle with a thermostat, and let Spooky out of her carrier.
Meow.
I remember to close the kitchen door just before the little fuzzball wanders out into the hall, then set my backpack down and start unloading supplies. Food bowl, water bowl, kibble. There's a thudding sound behind me. I whip round in a hurry, and am confronted by a mad, black-eyed stare from atop the kitchen table. "Hey, cat, what are you doing there? Get down!" Spooky levitates, as if a poltergeist has just grabbed her. She comes down on top of the kitchen unit, a good 2 meters away, then leaps again for the precarious gap between the top of the storage unit and the ceiling. "Oh, for fuck's sake!" I pause. Why the hell am I talking to a cat? I wonder, resolving to ignore her. She'll come down when she's hungry or needs the litter tray or something. It's been a long day, and I do not find it relaxing to chase an anti-gravity-enabled predator with a butterfly net. So I finish unpacking provisions instead, listen to the radiators gurgling away as our ancient central heating system struggles to emit a trickle of hot water, then haul out my battered netbook to spend some quality time anonymously stalking my relatives on Facebook. After about half an hour, I realize there's an unaccustomed warmth on my lap, and it's buzzing. This perplexes me for a few seconds until I realize what it is. Damn it, I've caught lap fungus. I carefully reach down with a fingertip, which Spooky sniffs, then attempts to pick her nose on. Then, while I'm trying to work out how to make a dash for the kitchen sink without being lacerated, I hear the front door opening.
"Hi, honey, I'm home."
It's Mo, of course. The joke may be threadbare, but it's not entirely worn out yet. But I instinctively move to stand up, at which point Spooky startles and emulates a rapidly deflating party balloon in terms of high-speed movement and random three-dimensional handbrake turns. She ends up crouched on top of the smoke extractor over the cooker, glowering at me as if I'm to blame. "In here," I call, standing and walking over to switch the kettle on. The kitchen door opens.
"What a day!"
Mo freezes, violin case in hand.
"What's that?"
she demands, bristling. Oh, dear. "Mo, meet Spooky. She's the stray who's been hanging out around the dumpsters at work. She followed me indoors today, and I was going to take her to the cat and dog home, but..."
"Oh, fair."
Mo plants her violin case on the kitchen table, removes her glasses, and rubs her eyes tiredly. No eyeshadow, I note, just old-fashioned exhaustion.
"It can't stay here. It's probably got fleas."
"Not anymore." Spooky has a shiny new flea collar. "Anyway, she doesn't have to stay, but I couldn't leave her in the new annex overnight. The cleaners would eat her."
"You didn't think to put her back outside?"
"The forecast said frost tonight." The kettle boils right then, so I busy my hands with the making of a pot of tea, leaving my brain free to chew over whether I'm simply making excuses or.
"Well, you're on litter tray duty. Not my problem. And if it craps in my shoes, it can look forward to a promising future as a violin string."
Spooky stares at Mo with enormous black eyes, pupils fully dilated. She looks as if she understands exactly what Mo is saying, and likes none of it. "Well, okay," I say. "But if you're so worried, how about we just spread a tarp or one of those gigantic plastic IKEA shopping bags over your precious footwear?"
"Fuh, it's my house. The lodgers are the ones who should go out of their way not to make waves."
She sits down, and I suppress a sigh of relief. "Bad day?" I ask.
"Terrible. First, I had 2 hours of instrument practice cancelled because of a problem with the anechoic damping in practice room 2. There was too much leakage. Turns out a dripping pipe in the ceiling had soaked some of the panels. Then I had another shitty committee meeting I shouldn't really talk about, all to do with the fallout from Vakalabad. Our people in the FO are going to deliver a strongly worded complaint, threaten to withhold cooperation if they don't promise to tell us the entire truth when they ask for assistance in future. There might even be some finger-wagging.
Which seems only reasonable to me.
Seems that what's gotten up certain people's collective nose isn't what the Pasdaran wanted me to do, but the way they went about it. I'm afraid I had a little snit.
Her eyes are puffy, I realise, and she usually spends a few minutes on cosmetic basics before interdepartmental sessions, suggesting... Oh, Mo. She waves it off.
I didn't break down or get excessively emotional in the meeting. I did raise my voice a little. Had to remind them I'm not a fucking human waste disposal machine. Crashed and burned afterwards.
I pivot slightly from teapot to drinks cupboard, wherein I locate the remains of the bottle of Glenmorangie from the other night. There are still a couple of fingers left in it, so I pour them all into a tumbler and shove it in front of her. Sun's over the yardarm. Drink.
If I must.
She looks morose. I turn back to the pot, add loose-leaf tea and hot water, and set it aside to brew.
There is a distinct lack of contact with the hard edges of reality in some parts of the organisation these days.
Alternatively, you spend too much time poking around corners of the envelope that sensible people stay away from, I propose.
Somebody's got to do it.
She stares at me. I had an interesting interview with Angleton today, I say, between meetings. Well, after one meeting. Then I sort of called another. I look guilty. I created a new committee.
Oh, really?
I think someone inside the organisation is trying to gaslight us.
Well, that'd be a first.
She knocks back a startlingly large gulp of water of life, then puts the tumbler down and fans herself.
Nobody in the history of the laundry has ever tried to pull the wool over anyone else's eyes.
Planet Earth calling?
Yes.
She pays attention, but she looks worried. My heart goes out to her, but I'm not sure how to break through the icy sheen of cynicism she's wrapping around herself. There's no such thing as vampires, I finger quote at her. I keep hearing that, even from people who know better.
But that's...
She peers at me.
Bob?
I peer back at her, confused. Didn't I tell you?
Tell me what?
I shake my head. I'm feeling distinctly fuzzed. I found them. Genuine no-shit vampires. I motor on, anticipating her resistance and not wanting this to turn into another argument. As in, they're super strong, can project at least a level 3 glamour, are predisposed for the practice of ritual magic, and they need factor 1 million sunblock to go outside in daylight. Oh, they also drink blood. Unfortunately, I didn't find them fast enough. Mary got there first and reactivated herself, and now HR are running in circles trying to draw up a policy for handling their special needs.
What? Mary who... Hang on, wasn't she your...
Yes, her. Mary Murphy. Back from the land of the merchant bankers and even crazier and more ambitious, in a blonde executive with sharp shoulder pads and sharper fangs kind of way. Mo stares at me for a moment, clearly wondering if I've taken leave of my senses. Then she takes another sip of whiskey and sits back, the gears visibly beginning to mesh.
You've verified this, I take it?
Oh, hell yes. I count off points on my fingers. Epidemiological factors. We've got a whole new thermodegenerative neuropathy to deal with, tentatively called V syndrome. Andy can vouch for my research on the data mining side. That's all logged confidential, opera cape. Then we've got the HR briefing and the Dresden Rice Committee currently sitting. The clusterfuck when I confronted them, well, you can find it filed under Blue Dandelion. And I just set up another one, Green Lime, although we haven't got very far yet. That one is investigating the possibility that for some time now, we've been infested with fangfuckers telling everyone to shut up and look the other way because there's no such thing as vampires. There's an odd double thud. I look round. Spooky has teleported from the extractor hood to the worktop and is now sniffing the electric kettle suspiciously.
Vampires? You sure? That can't be right.
They're not fucking Dracula, but they're close enough for government work. It's fallout from an algorithm research group supporting the quantitative trading desks at one of our larger banks. Turns out, a rather rare combination of a multidimensional visualization system and a particular area of group theory makes mild-mannered mathematicians grow fangs. Anyway, the first of them only turned about 5 or 6 weeks ago. He turned his colleagues, and they went all agile on it, exploring the parameters, which triggered the V-syndrome spike in Tower Hamlets, which led me to them.
"Where does Mary come into all this?"
Mo asks, still sounding confused.
"I thought she got shown the door years ago."
"Too right. She was on the permanent sabbatical list. Trouble is, they showed her the door by way of an entrance interview with an investment bank. She's been management track ever since and ended up as second in command on this team. So they turned her. And she knew about us, so she phoned it in, and as an ex-HR body, she knew exactly how to induct her little bat buddies into the laundry. Did it in the nick of time, too, just before I turned up with an Oculus truck and half of Special Branch in tow.
Oh, good God."
Mo doesn't believe in any gods other than the ones I believe in, but the expostulation comes instinctively. "I know it's not a bunch of bloody-handed lunatics from the Middle East, love, but I have had my hands ever so slightly full this past week."
"Vampires?"
She takes another sip of whiskey. Her shoulders are shaking with suppressed laughter or anger or something.
"Blood-sucking fiends?"
More shaking. I can't tell whether it's mirth or hysteria, which worries me.
"Poor Bob."
I ignore the cat. "It's not funny," I say stiffly. "They drink blood. Not much, but the donors die of something like Kranzberg syndrome." It's like a sneeze, and it passes just as fast.
"What?"
I said, their victims die. I'm guessing there's a sympathetic connection. Whatever gives them their vampiric superpowers is like the K syndrome parasite. But instead of chewing down on their own grey matter, it uses them as a vector, to take blood meals that allow them to sample many more victims.
"Oh. Oh, shit."
She drains the glass.
"What are you going to do about it?"
"What can I do?" The tea's brewed. I pour myself a mug. "Right now, we don't even know if they have to drink blood to survive, or if it's optional. Right now, we're still gathering data. Right now, I suspect we've had a fangfucker in the organisation all along, telling us they don't exist. The intensity of collective denial has been, shall we say, anomalous." Spooky, tired of being ignored, starts gently bumping her head against my ankle. "Buzz, if you could keep your eyes open, I'd be very grateful. Coordinate with Jerry and Angleton and Andy. I've got a bad feeling about this." It is traditional, at this juncture in the narrative, to insert yet another Hollywood-style montage of diligent bureaucrats sleeplessly combing the archives in search of clues to the identity of the enemy mole within their organisation. Optional, one of them is stabbed in the jugular by said mole while working late. They use their last 5 minutes not to call for an ambulance, but to compose an amusing cryptogram naming their assailant, and to fingerpaint it on the underside of their desk using their own blood as ink, where it is found the next morning by facilities and promptly cleaned up before anyone with a clue gets to see it. Well, fuck that shit. What actually happens is called division of labour, with a nod and a wink to security protocols. Andy and I send Pete away to draw up a questionnaire about vampires and why people think they don't exist, emphasis on the why. We want to find out if vampire denialism is a statistical anomaly, so we plan to use his church as a control cohort. If anyone asks, he can soft soap it as an inquiry into the level of belief in supernatural phenomena among his parishioners. We remind him to keep this away from Alex for the time being. Andy has a whole bunch of clearances for keyword access to confidential files. I have a whole bunch of clearances for etc. We're not going to search secret sources at this point. The flaming hoops we'd have to jump through would leave us seriously scorched. As it is, our confidential clearances overlap, but are disjoint sets. So we go to the security coordination desk and ask the blue suiter on duty to generate lists specific to each of us and a shared list we can split down the middle. We both have blanket permission for archive searches on anything over a century old, and for newer stuff that's classified but has passed its expiration date. This being the laundry, we don't publish our declassified archives for the general public, but employees can get access more or less at will once it has expired. Most of this material is available from our computerized document retrieval system these days, so it's a lot like doing a university library literature search, except grubbier and more esoteric. Search keyword, vampire. Searching. 19,260 results. Listing page 1 of 771. Did you know that if you search for vampire in books on Amazon.com, you will get approximately 33,770 results? We don't have quite that many documents on the topic. A lot of our search hits are duplicates. But it looks as if, for a long period, from about 1792 through 1969, every single vampire novel published in the United Kingdom was read and synopsized by our Occult Entities Monitoring Desk, or the Zoological Inquiry Bureau, or the Linnean Anomalies Committee. It got renamed every couple of decades like clockwork. I am absolutely gobsmacked to discover this. I already knew that we had far more information about unicorns on file than seems strictly necessary to anyone without equestrian red sirloin clearance. But vampires? You can't even write it off as the work of a single demented fan. Not when it ran for 177 years. Well, 153 years. We have synopses going back to 1792. But the first folios didn't get compiled until 1816. But wait, there's more! There is a once-classified, top-secret, 50-year rule file on one Abraham Stoker of London. Died April 20th, 1912. It's quite thick and appears to contain a bunch of PV interview records with his friends and family for pre-First World War values of positive vetting. Full of comments along the lines of, "Jolly good chap, eminently clubbable for an Irishman." I checked with HR, and there's no record that we ever employed him. There's a report of an investigation, circa 1899, into the book Dracula, which appears to have investigated the possibility that it was based on fact, and drew a blank. A much more urgent investigation into The Lair of the White Worm followed in 1912, but Mr. Stoker was indisposed to answer questions in person, and the investigator hinted darkly that excited delirium due to an unspeakable ailment had more to do with the phantasmagoric, not to say misogynistic, visions in that book than any supernatural experience. There are all sorts of other things, investigations into silent movies and TV serials. I pulled the file on Quatermass for shits and giggles. Strictly speaking, not germane to the project in hand, but I'd hit burnout by that point and badly needed some relief reading that wasn't the 11th Harry Dresden novel. As I implied earlier, the frequency of reports tailed off after the late 1950s, until there were only a couple a year coming in, and then everything stopped dead, as if guillotined, on April 5, 1969. April 5th. You know what that means to me? That means the budget for the project expired at the end of financial year 1968 and was not renewed. Yes, British government budgets, and the tax year start on April 6th. Why are you looking at me like that? Don't your tax years start and stop on a random date in April? I finally save the spreadsheet I've been using to keep track of this shit, mutter bingo quietly, and email Pete and Andy, inviting them to an impromptu team-building exercise in the Turk's Head round the corner. Trebles all round. I've found what I'm looking for. Meanwhile, in another office, a meeting is taking place, and I haven't been invited to it, or even informed of it, even though I'm the subject. Mahogany Row in the new annex lacks the plush 19th-century gentlemen's club ambience of the original, but it's still a step up from our regular offices. Both figuratively and literally, it's on the top floor. It has thicker carpets and nicer bathrooms. There are no cubicles, and some of the offices have outer vestibules for the executive PAs. However, the new annex was built in the 1970s, so it lacks a whole bunch of modern conveniences we grunts take for granted. Who'd spec out a desk with a blotter and a rotary dial telephone but no power and network points for laptops, or even electric typewriters? Nevertheless, sometimes it's a good idea to have an office that is discreetly shielded. No outside windows, no electrical appliances except the carefully checked overhead lights, and Faraday shielding hidden behind the Laura Ashley wallpaper. And it's in one of these offices that a conclave of old monsters are having an informal chat.
"Are we secure?"
asks Lockhart.
"Yes."
Angleton laces his fingers together and looks at the third man present, who nods mildly. This worthy is the senior auditor, and the mere idea that he might be taking an interest in my affairs... Well, it's a good thing I have no idea about this meeting, or I'd be hiding under Spooky's litter tray and gibbering instead of dragging Pete and Andy off for a wee celebratory bevy down the pub. Ignorance, as they say, is bliss. Neither the auditor nor Lockhart bother to ask just how Angleton knows they are secure. Some capabilities are simply trusted to exist.
"What's the latest news, then?"
asks the senior auditor. With his silver hair, grey suit and half-moon reading glasses, he could pass for a distinguished partner in a law or accountancy firm. But even the likes of Angleton and Lockhart are slightly on edge in his presence.
"Hmm."
Lockhart glances sidelong at Angleton.
"Well."
Angleton grins, an expression strangely at home on his sallow face, but rarely seen by the likes of me.
"I had to give the lad a nudge, Jerry, but I think he's probably working along the right lines now."
The grin vanishes abruptly.
"He appeared to be distracted."
"Hmm."
Lockhart glances down at the day planner in his lap.
"Well, that's not surprising. Unfortunately, Agent Candid may be becoming a stability issue, and he'd be the first to know. That business out east. Shocking."
The senior auditor nods.
"But there is clearly a matter of priorities for us to discuss here,"
he says smoothly.
"We have benefited from two excellent assets meshing frictionlessly for too long, or at least providing each other with mutual support."
"But the current inquiry..."
Lockhart's moustache twitches.
"It was inevitable, I'm afraid. As with all such phenomena, the closer the Great Alignment comes, the more frequently we'll have to deal with outbreaks like this, especially when inside meddling is implicated. Sooner or later, one of our night-crawling friends was bound to make a power play, or perhaps it's just another of their interminable duels. It's just unfortunate for us that the nexus in question involves Agent Candid's partner's former lover. The threat surface is wider than usual."
The senior auditor trails off into a thoughtful silence.
"Agent Candid, in combination with her instrument, is a major offensive asset. We can't permit trivial insults to jeopardize her efficiency."
Angleton's expression is stony, but he holds his counsel.
"That may be true," Lockhart ventures. "But what about Agent Howard? He's on the tier below, but coming along nicely. In the long term..."
He glances sidelong at Angleton.
"He may be an even more important asset."
"I am aware of that,"
says the senior auditor. A slight stiffening of his spine and a glint of light from his glasses causes Lockhart to purse his lips.
"Now tell me about Ms. Murphy and Mr. Menendez."
Lockhart flicks through a few pages.
"Oscar Menendez. Nothing special. He's your usual managerial overachiever, very bright, organizationally highly competent, and about as untrustworthy as... Well, I wouldn't have chosen to bring him in, let's put it that way. He might be useful if he manages to avoid making any fatal errors of judgment in the short term, but for the time being I'd be inclined to put him in a padded box and throw away the key. He doesn't really understand that we're not playing by the rules he's used to."
"And Ms. Murphy?"
Lockhart's moustache thins.
"She's much more interesting, if you ask me. We originally recruited her straight out of university in more innocent days. The if-someone-sees-something dragnet was still practical back then. She was badly mishandled by her original managerial oversight people. Let go, given a discharge placement in the bank. then turned out not to be a waste of space after all.
And now she's back as a vampire. And she actually kept her coven alive and survived as such for nearly 6 weeks. That's quite an achievement.
The auditor nods to himself.
What is the life expectancy of a vampire in this day and age, anyway?
Asks Lockhart.
96 hours,
Angleton says dryly.
It's been shortening progressively ever since the 1960s, although most of the initial die-off is down to the sane ones working out their likely fate and killing themselves to avoid it. If they survive longer than a year, vanishingly rare these days, there's no obvious upper limit.
Except for the ceilings imposed by epidemiology.
And fratricidal predation, yes.
Angleton meets the senior auditor's gaze with his own unblinking expression.
Bob knows it is his duty to keep Miss Murphy alive for the sake of the organization. He's a clever boy, and he'll work out the angles for himself. The risks, I believe, are that Miss Murphy will underestimate and try to manipulate him, or that Agent Candid will prove to be an insurmountable distraction rather than a pillar of strength.
Human relationships are so painfully messy.
The senior auditor looks away. He carefully removes his glasses and starts to polish their lenses with the end of his tie.
But for the greater good.
If Agent Howard expresses concern about Agent Candid, I believe he will come to me in the first instance, says Angleton. So we will have sufficient warning. It would be expedient to have an urgent assignment ready for her, though.
A wild goose chase? Asks Lockhart.
No, that would potentially make things worse if she can see through it. But don't overstress her. The business out east.
Vile, I know.
Lockhart looks at the senior auditor.
She should really be on sick leave, you know.
I am aware of that.
The senior auditor replaces his spectacles.
But she is dangerously close to indispensable.
We should find a plausible task that is important enough to demand her full attention, while being unlikely to generate additional stress in the Howard-O'Brien household, and which takes her away from home while not placing her at such a remove that we can't call her back in a hurry if we need her.
Yes.
The auditor falls silent for a moment.
She's cleared for Blue Hades, isn't she? The upcoming treaty renewal negotiations.
That'll do it. Come to think of it, they know her, which gives it even more plausibility.
Angleton is nodding now.
It doesn't do to show them a weak front. It makes perfect sense for us to send her along with the delegation.
Lockhart interrupts.
But if she's on a disused gas platform in the North Sea...
That's what helicopters are for.
The auditor looks at him.
We need to clear the stage for the next act of this little drama, so that the reluctant star can be tempted into the floodlights to deliver his soliloquy. See to it.
There is a booth at the back of the Turk's Head, and I plant Andy and Pete in it before I go to the bar to retrieve 2 pints of Adnams, a Diet Coke, and a bowl of olives. Having done my duty as honorary barmaid, I amble around the public rooms, sliding my way between knots of chattering post-work imbibers and idly patrolling past the various other booths and the former smoking room and lounge. The new and thoroughly tested ward I wear on a thong under my T-shirt stays cold and inert, which is good. This one isn't only sensitive to sympathetic entanglement and glamours, it's also supposed to pick up most electronic proxies for human malice. Sweeping for bugs in a public space like this is a fool's errand in the age of the cell phone, all of which by definition contain sensitive microphones and radio transmitters, but I can be reasonably certain that nobody in here means to do me harm. By the time I get back to the booth, Pete is a couple of centimetres down his Diet Coke, and Andy is looking at me curiously.
"Is this what I think it is?"
he asks, tapping his e-cig on the table. "Could be." I slide into my seat. I found the photographic negative of a smoking gun. Trouble is, an absence isn't proof positive, even if it's a highly suggestive absence. How about you?
I got nothing.
Andy pauses.
Was it inside?
He glances sidelong at Pete, who is focusing on his glass but clearly paying quiet attention. I address my next words to Pete. If you think something's smelly in the house, you talk about it outside, and vice versa. What Andy is asking is, do we have an internal problem? You may have noticed me walking around earlier. I was checking for listeners. Didn't find any, by the way. I look at Andy. We had a very thorough monitoring program running for a very long time indeed, but it seems to have been deprioritized in the late 60s and cut off in 69.
Oh, really?
Andy taps his cigarette again. The blue LED in the tip flickers on briefly. He fumbles with it for a moment, hunting the on-off switch, then gives up and takes a furtive hit, shielding it inside his cupped hand like an old lag.
Who do we know who's been with the organization since 1969? Or earlier?
It's not Angleton, I say dismissively. Angleton may be unaging and extremely scary, but he's not a vampire. I've seen him in daylight. Besides, I probably know more about the Eater of Souls than anyone else in the laundry. Certainly enough to rule him out as a suspect.
Really?
I can vouch for him. I glance at Pete minutely, and Andy nods, getting the picture. Unless Angleton had some other reason to squelch the old vampire monitoring program, it's not him. And as he's on... Andy nods again. Pete has no need to know about Blue Dandelion. So I change the subject away from sensitive topics. Pete, what have you discovered so far?
Oh, that's easy.
He looks up.
Would you believe that of 46 parishioners informally polled, 36 of them believe in the existence of evil incarnate in the person of the devil?
He sighs.
Well, their average age was somewhere north of 60, and they're self-selected for being frequent attendees at religious services, so there was bound to be an element of literal-mindedness to them. But, taking the devil as a baseline, the really interesting thing is that 40 of them believe in vampires. Over 85%. Vampires are outpolling Satan in the bogeyman charts this decade.
He takes a mouthful of fizz.
Mind you, I added a couple of control questions. I said they were a self-selected sample. 52% of them think gays are going to hell, and 39% think the Earth was created late one Saturday night in October of 4004 BC.
He looks pained.
I can see I have some sermons to write on the subject of metaphor and creation myths. And tolerance.
What about the office? I ask.
Well, I had a problem there. I emailed the same questionnaire to the entire department, and Jack from the security office came round to have a little chat about asking questions.
Oh, shit, Andy and I say, nearly simultaneously.
No, it was quite all right.
Pete looks startled at our reaction.
I explained that I was sending out the poll because you'd asked me to.
I tense.
Then I asked if he really believed in vampires or Satan. So we had a good chuckle and he went away. Answer was no and no, by the way.
The cold sweat that began to spring up the instant Pete mentioned Jack from security is drying. I share a knowing look with Andy. Mentally, I'm kicking myself. Tasking Pete with asking questions of his church parishioners? That's totally fine. Pete asking questions of random passers-by in a secret government security organization is another matter entirely. I should have seen this coming. By nature, he's an organizer, so of course he'd mail-bomb the entire department, and of course security would prick up their ears the instant someone not on their radar began asking questions. Even innocent-sounding ones. Demarcation and Chinese walls and OPSEC and need-to-know rule our procedures. Those of us who are on the ladder and have worked together for over a decade sometimes cut corners to get things done, but a new inductee is another matter entirely. Luckily, everyone in the laundry knows that Satan doesn't exist. We have worse nightmares to keep us awake in the dark.
Pete, Andy says, calmly enough, I don't think you should get into the habit of asking questions on unclassified mail lists. In fact, before you do that again, just make a point of checking if it's okay with me or Bob, right? We wouldn't want you to get into trouble.
Oh, I see.
Pete is subdued. perhaps a little surprised at how scared we both looked for a moment, not realizing that we're not scared for us, we're scared for him. "Did you get any results?" I ask, leaning forward.
Yes, Pete brightens. "Mostly from junior staff and new inductees. I included a time of service question, and the median was 15 months. It turns out that of the 18 responses I got, nobody at all believes in Satan, and only two believe in vampires. Those two were recent inductees, by the way. Time of service, less than 12 months. Age is much more representative than the church survey, averaging 32. Outliers as young as 21 and as old as, well, one joker wrote in that they were 231, and what was my blood group, please?" Pete stops and stares at me, then at Andy. "That was a joke, right?" he asks uncertainly. "Wasn't it? Do you still have the responses?" I ask, trying to keep my voice level and even and unfrightening. "Sure, they're in the mail archive I created for them."
"What do you think?" I ask Andy.
"I think..."
Andy looks as worried as I feel.
"It's probably a joke. Probably."
"Well then," I say, pushing my mostly undrunk pint glass away, "let's go and find out, shall we?" I stand up.
"What, right now?"
asks Pete. "When better?" But when we get back to Pete's office, he can't find his mailbox full of survey responses. I spend a fruitless and frustrating hour digging around with some forensics tools and grovelling over log files. And finally, I work out what happened. Pete did indeed save all his survey responses to a mail archive, but he stashed it on the local drive of the PC he was working on, which is, of course, connected to our NAS. And for some reason, when he logged out, the VM image he was working on didn't get uploaded back to the storage array. So when we came storming back into the office and Pete logged himself in for me, he downloaded a stale copy of the VM he'd been working with, which scribbled all over the local copy with the mail archive. And because we are the laundry and we are hip to the whole InfoSec thing, these days our desktop PCs store everything local in a rather expensive PCIe RAM disk card. Not even flash. Flash memory retains data when you pull the plug, with whole disk encryption. And it's soldered to the PC's chassis, precisely because we don't want random interlopers to be able to trivially retrieve erased files. Somewhere in the guts of the departmental mail server, there's a log file recording the origin and destination of every email message that was delivered to Pete's desktop client, or anybody else's for that matter. But somehow, I don't expect to find Pete's joker listed in it. In the process of confirming that belief in vampires is bizarrely, implausibly low within the organisation, and that an active surveillance programme was discontinued more than 40 years ago, we've blundered into a tripwire. And now they know we know.